good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path Radio Broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and I'm sure that many of you are wondering, since it is a holiday, whether this is live or whether it's Memorex. And in fact, it is live. Memorial Day, Monday, here in 2013, if this is the day you're listening to the program between 2 and 3 in the afternoon Pacific time, then you are listening to a live broadcast the same as any other weekday that we normally do the same thing. And what we do, if you're not familiar, is we open our phone lines for callers if they have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith. And if you do have such questions, I'd like to invite you to call, and we can talk about the things you have questions about. The number to call is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. I'm not sure if everything's working out technologically here. Okay, we've got a switchboard that's lighting up and then going offline and things like that. I'm not sure what's going on there, but give me a call, and I'm hopefully going to be able to put you on the air and talk to you about your questions, or if you have alternate viewpoints from that of the host. Let me just tell the engineer, you don't have to put the caller on, just put the caller's name there and I can put them on. Okay, just type in their name right there and I'll put them on the air when I'm ready for them. We're breaking in some new talent here. The number again is 1-800-438-5090. Let me see if I've got a caller here. It's kind of hard to tell. Hello, welcome to the Narrow Path. Is there a caller there?
Hello, sir.
Yes.
Yeah, Tom and Salinas.
Tom and Salinas?
Yes.
Welcome. Thanks for calling.
Okay, anyway, am I talking to
You're talking to the host of the program, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, you were talking last week on three different or four different versions of hell?
Yeah, three different views of hell, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, anyway, on John 3:16, doesn't that say that you're either to everlasting life or everlasting punishment or something like that?
Well, what it says is God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him would not perish, but have everlasting life.
Right. But then the other part is not then mentioned there.
The other part what?
Okay. But I was looking at my Bible earlier this morning, and I thought that the other section was everlasting punishment or something like that.
Well, there is a reference to everlasting punishment in Matthew chapter 25 and verse 46. It's the only place in the Bible that uses that term, everlasting punishment, but it's talking about the sheep and the goats, and it says that the goats go away into everlasting punishment.
Okay, then now I understand what 21.
All right, so do you have a question?
No, that's done.
Okay.
In the same verse, two verses together, but it's not.
All right. Well, thank you for your call.
Okay.
Bye now. Okay, so the tendency I think the caller is referring to is that we read one verse like that in Matthew 25, 46, where it talks about everlasting punishment. And then we read a verse about perishing, and we figure that the two things mean the same thing, and maybe they do. And that's really how we do theology, generally speaking. We take passages that are on the same subject, but which offer different information about them, and we synthesize them, which is, I think, the right thing to do. If two authors, or three or four, talk about the same subject, and they all are authoritative on the subject, then we take what they say and we add it up together and get the total picture. There's very seldom a case where a whole theological topic is covered in one verse very thoroughly. So we take the verses from different places. So I can see what you mean. You thought that the reference to eternal punishment was found in John 3:16. It's actually found in Matthew 25:46. All right. I do see we're having some trouble managing our calls, but anyway, just my call screen is working on this, trying to fix this. So let me just take a call, or let's take a question that was written in, and do please continue to call, and our call screener will work on getting you lined up to talk with me here. In fact, perhaps I could do something in that area. I'm not sure. Let me hit a button here and see if I get this caller on the air. Hello. No, I'm not getting that caller. Not getting. There we go. Hello. Welcome.
Hello, welcome.
You're on the air. Thank you for calling. Oh, he got hung up. Okay. I think we've got something going wrong in the studio, and hopefully we'll get that going right, because the purpose of the call is to talk to callers, and our callers are having trouble getting through. Let me talk about a question that's been written in to me here. Doug wrote in and said, what kind of support are we as Christians supposed to give to the state of Israel? Well, this, of course, presupposes that we're supposed to give some kind of support to the state of Israel. In fact, it suggests perhaps that we're supposed to give some kind of support uniquely to the state of Israel, differently than we would give to other states or other nations. First of all, I don't believe that Christianity has as its mission the support of any state, any political entity. Okay, it's a good thing for Christians to be law-abiding citizens of the countries they're in, and to commend the good behavior of their nation and to speak out against the bad behavior of their nation. And I would assume that would be our role to do similar things in terms of critiquing other states, whether it's Germany or Argentina or Israel or Jordan or Syria or China or Japan. It doesn't really matter. I mean, states are states. They're political institutions capable of doing some good and some evil. And most states are a mixture of both. There's some good and some evil. What should a Christian's attitude toward be toward a country? Well, I think the Christian should have the same attitudes God has, that evil is wrong, no matter what nation commits it, and that good should be commended, no matter which nation commits it or practices it. Now, this would be true of Israel, too, because Israel also is a political state. So I think Christians would be in a position to commend Israel at times and to criticize Israel at times, because like any other nation, Israel has its good and its bad. Now, of course, the question arises apparently from the fact that many Christians feel that Israel is different than other nations in a Christian's estimation, that the Christian should see Israel not like other nations, but especially an interest to Christians for one reason or another. Usually the reason given would be that the nation of Israel was chosen by God back in the Old Testament. The people of Israel were chosen to be a special people and special nation. And therefore, we should look at the modern nation of Israel that way. But that does not necessarily follow, because the modern nation of Israel is not a continuation of the older nation of Israel. For example, back in biblical times, the nation of Israel, the political nation, had its center of activity in the temple, in the worship of God. In other words, it was a worshiping nation. They didn't always worship well, and they didn't always behave well, but they were nonetheless established as a nation around the worship of God. That is not true of the modern nation of Israel. The modern nation of Israel is secular. It does not have a temple, nor does it have a state religion. And therefore, that would put it in a really different category than ancient Israel. It's not the same state. It's not the same country. It doesn't have the same people in it. You know, the people who were in ancient Israel are dead now. The people in modern Israel are different people. And so it's really, you know, kind of a mistake, it seems to me, to assume that what can be said about the ancient state of Israel somehow is related to the modern state of Israel. There's near as I can tell, there's no connection, except that they're both called Israel. Now, someone might say, well, no, there is a difference, and that is that the Jews live there. Well, some Jews live there, and some Jews don't. Some Gentiles live there, and some Gentiles don't. That was true in biblical times, too, and that's true of virtually every nation in the world. America's that way. Some Jews live in America. Some people who aren't Jews live in America. Same is true in Israel. There's more Jews that live outside of Israel than there are in Israel. So, again, that doesn't seem to me to be a distinguishing characteristic between it and other nations. The real thing that most Christians, I think, do with the state of Israel is they assume that its existence was a fulfillment of prophecy, and it was something that God wanted to have happen in the end times, and that alone gives many Christians reason to thoughtlessly support everything Israel does. But of course, even if it is a fulfillment of prophecy, that doesn't mean that God isn't critical of their bad behavior if they misbehave. God wants all nations to behave, and even in the Old Testament, when Israel misbehaved, he sent the prophets to criticize them. So God is critical of bad behavior, even in the nation of Israel when it was his people. If the modern nation of Israel is God's people still, which I don't think the Bible teaches that, but if it is, God would be just as critical of their bad behavior now as he would have been back in the days of the prophets, I would assume. So there's really no carte blanche that the Christian can give to any nation, including the nation of Israel. But Christians should be just and equitable in their assessment of any nation. As far as giving special support to the nation of Israel, there's not one line in Scripture that would advocate that. Some Christians like to support Israel. Some like to support other countries. Some just like to support their own country. That's, I suppose, your own call as you understand God to be leading you in your stewardship to support. But there is certainly no biblical basis for the Christian to consider himself obligated to give special support to the nation of Israel as opposed to any other nation. Now, I believe we've got Vince from Las Vegas online. I hope that we can get this call activated. I think we have it. Hi, Vince. Welcome.
How are you doing, Steve?
Good, thanks. Thanks for calling.
I'm glad to hear that. Steve, I just wanted to throw out some thoughts to you on Isaiah 14, because I know you and I in the past have differed on positions in a lot of areas, but I wanted to come up with the point of view that there is some information here that suggests that this could be talking about not necessarily Satan himself, but an angel. And I know it uses the word man in the context, and in the Bible, when a man does appear or an angel does appear, it's often described as a man within it. Now, we don't have any studies on demon crossover or evil spirit crossover into the physical realm, but throughout the Bible, you have people like Gabriel, Manoah and his wife, the angels that were at Sodom and Gomorrah, they're all mentioned as men. So I wanted to throw out this thought to you and see, you know, if you could at least see that there is a possibility. In Isaiah 14:12, the name of the person there that's being talked about is Star of the Morning.
Yeah.
And star is a term that is used for angels typically in Job. Morning stars are a reference to prior to creation. And its element here, when I go and look at, you know, the likelihood that this could be possibility, there's only one place in the Bible where it talks about anyone fallen from heaven, and those are the terms that are used in Isaiah 14. It talks that this particular person fell from heaven. We've seen for believers, people can fall from faith, they could fall from grace, they could fall back, but we've never seen anywhere in the Bible where a person has fallen from heaven, except within Luke 10:18, where Jesus says that I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven. So wouldn't that suggest the possibility that this is an angelic being that fell from heaven, and this could be an angel, especially since the context does not fit any man that we know of?
Stay on the line. I mean, I'm going to answer that, and if you have more points to make, we can get to them too. But let me, before we accumulate too many points without me responding to any of them, and therefore probably getting me to forget some of them, let me talk about those points first, and then we'll take some more if you have some more points besides that.
Sure.
First of all, the idea that the person in Isaiah 14 is called a man, and as you said, angels in the Bible are sometimes called men. As near as I can tell, they're only called men when they appear on earth to human beings. That is, I think that when God sends angels to communicate with people on earth, he sends them in a human-like form, so that they are often referred to as a man in white clothing or something like that appeared. And obviously this doesn't mean that they're really a human being. They're really angels. But obviously we wouldn't want to assume every time we encounter the word man in the Bible that this must be an angel. In fact, it would very rarely be the case. In Isaiah 14, when the king of Babylon, who is being addressed here, is called a man, it is not when he's appearing to humans. It's when he's in Sheol. It says, you'll be cast down into Sheol, verse 15 says, to the lowest depths of the pit. Those who see you, apparently those in Sheol who see you, will gaze at you and consider you, saying, is this the man who made earth tremble? So this isn't the case of an angel appearing or anyone appearing to human beings. This is somebody punished down in Sheol and referred to there as a man. It seems if that is an angel being called a man, well, then that would simply be a unique case. And, maybe it is. Maybe it is. But it certainly isn't analogous to the cases of angels appearing to people in human form. But now, as far as the star of the morning being referenced as the an angel, you pointed out that in Job, the morning stars that sang for joy are apparently they're equated with the sons of God. And that might be a reference to angels. That's very possible. I know some people who question that, and there is grounds for questioning it. But let's not argue that point. Let's take your point as a given. Let's say that in Job, the morning stars there are a reference to angels. That does not help us necessarily to know whether the book of Numbers or the book of Isaiah or the book of Revelation would use the same imagery. For example, Jesus is called the bright morning star in Revelation 22. In fact, it's essentially the same concept, the star of the morning star. But Jesus is not an angel. In the book of Numbers, Balaam said he saw the star of Judah. And we usually believe that's a reference to Christ, but there's actually nothing in the passage to suggest he's referring to an angel. Here, that a king would be called the morning star would be, it's possible that it's an angel, but it doesn't say so. And there have been, it would not, to my mind, be reasonable to simply cross-reference Job and say, well, Job and Isaiah are using it the same way, when in fact lots of persons do not in the Bible. I mean, Daniel uses the word stars also, not with reference to angels. It says, those who turn many to righteousness shall shine as the stars forever. So stars sometimes are like people or Jesus or angels, or lots of different things, and therefore we wouldn't be able to bring the way Job uses morning stars necessarily into Isaiah's writings and say, well, he would be using it the same way. He could, but there'd be no default reason for thinking that that's the case.
You know, what's interesting is all the references that you use there seem to allude to a spirit being. Whether it's Daniel, they will be like the stars. With Jesus, the stars, star of the morning. They're all spirit creations, which would be what my guess angels is.
Well, Jesus actually isn't a spirit being; he's a man.
Well, in his eternal existence, he's a spirit.
Well, right, but he's not. He's not a disembodied spirit now. He rose from the dead, so he's a man. He's a glorified man now.
Yeah, but you agree he's always existed.
In Revelation 22, when Jesus calls himself the bright morning star, he's not talking about his pre-incarnate state. He's talking about who he is as a resurrected, glorified Christ.
Well, you talk about the man, and by the way, I honestly have a little bit different beliefs, and I guess I'm arguing for something that has a different belief than what I have. But as far as the man, but what I noticed in verse 12, it says that he was cut to earth, So he wasn't inert, but brought down to earth. Now, where you reference Revelation 12 often within the context of Satan being cast out of heaven, there seems to be a distinction between a fall and being thrown. You know, there seems to be that element. So within the context there, they seem to have their differences.
You're right that there are places in the New Testament that speak of Satan fallen from heaven. I'll grant you that. But I think you're mistaken in saying he's the only one who is said to be. Because actually this passage in Isaiah 14, though it's not quoted in the New Testament anywhere, it is alluded to as the marginal references in your New Testament will show you in Matthew chapter 11. In Matthew 11, verse 23, Jesus said, "And you, Capernaum, who are exalted to heaven, will be brought down to Hades." Now, Hades is the same as Sheol. And so it's just as the morning star in Isaiah 14 was said to ascend into heaven, but he'll be brought down to Sheol. This is exactly the same thing that is said about Capernaum. And Capernaum was not an angel.
I think you're missing, Steve, though, on that. Within verse 12, it gives a starting point and it gives the ending point. It says he's fallen from heaven. Heaven was a starting point and earth is the ending point. So it makes a little bit more distinctive.
I'm afraid you're wrong, because it actually says that he said in verse 13, "I will ascend into heaven." Okay, so the starting point is earth. He ascends into heaven, but then he's cast out of heaven. This is a reference, of course, to the Tower of Babel.
Explain that in 12? That seems to be an apparent contradiction.
No.
Or perhaps he went up and then he was cast back down?
Exactly. This is exactly what it is. He's saying that the king of Babylon, or representing Babylon itself, as the king always does, represent the country in the prophecies, sought to ascend into heaven. But from there, he's fallen down or cast down. And, of course, it's talking about the origin of the nation of Babylon. Babylon began at the Tower of Babel in Genesis 11. And what was it that they wanted to do? They wanted to ascend into heaven. They wanted to build a tower with its top in the clouds. Well,
so then
they were cast down from there.
Is it Nimrod? Is it Nimrod that you believe this interpretation is based on?
I believe it is referring back to what Nimrod did, but the modern king of Babylon in question is not Nimrod. Babylon is an entity that existed from the time of Nimrod on until it fell after Isaiah's day. He's referring to Babylon as a whole, and its current king is its agent or its representative.
Here's why I have such a strong problem with it. In verse, it talks that the whole earth is at rest, never happened after Babylon fell. You know, there's a lot of distinctions about this, and there's a lot of fuzziness. Like in verse 15, it talks about this individual going to the pit, and in verse 20, it talks about the people that he won't be united with in burial, that he's cast from his tomb and not allowed to, you know, go into where they're going.
Are you of the opinion then that an angel is buried in a tomb?
No, actually, I hold a different opinion in it. I'm looking from the original American Standard Version, and I see the word "saying" is an added word in verse 16. I study from a more Jewish perspective, so I'm looking at the first part of this in reference to myself. I gravitate toward it being Satan. And the second part where that saying comes in is more or less the way of typing the father, Satan, with his son, the Antichrist. And so there's talking, the way I look at it, from two individuals. Verse 15 is talking about the judgment on Satan. Verse 20 is talking about the judgment on the Antichrist, who is killed by Christ when he comes back, but immediately resurrected. And again, it's a different belief than you have, where everybody else is going to Hades or Sheol. I believe he goes to the lake of fire. I believe all hell and the lake of fire, I identify him a little bit different in my theology, that they're two distinctively different places, that eventually hell will be cast into it.
Okay. Well, so, I appreciate you clarifying that.
I guess our theologies kind of dictate where we go.
It definitely is. Yeah, I'd prefer to take it really within its own context. And not try to read into it such things, whether it's a Jewish perspective or not. We know that the Jewish perspective was not something that Jesus had a lot of respect for. He dissed the traditions of the rabbis in a big way. and said that the disciples should beware of the teaching of the Pharisees, which were, of course, following the rabbinic teachings.
Well, when I say Jewish perspective, that's not what I mean, because the whole book of Hebrews and references by Paul as Jesus being the sacrificial lamb and, you know, the Lamb of God.
This passage in Isaiah isn't relative to that.
Isaiah, by ancient Jews, has always believed to be a fallen angel.
Well, yeah, but whatever they've felt, it's not found in the context. What I'm saying is, it was a rabbinic tradition to refer to this as a fallen angel is not something that comes from the passage itself or from any other passage being compared with it. It's a rabbinic tradition.
Rabbinic tradition teaches that Gog is the Antichrist. If you go off a rabbinic tradition.
Well, I don't care what they teach.
I know. But anyways, thanks, Steve, for the time. I just wanted to throw some thoughts out there and see what you thought. And, you know, and just from a point of view standpoint, you know, we have different points of view. I will go back and relook at your point of view as far as this. But I believe I'm staying within the context. And within the context of it, the world did not cease and come to peace after the king of Babylon was fallen at any time. Even the typology of the cedar trees and the cypress trees, they're types for northern Israel, which was under constant threat of attack. It was the most active areas of attack throughout its history. And so they're typed for Jewish peoples and things of all, like the trees of the field, they'll clap their hand as talking. It's figuratizing people as trees. It's not personifying the trees as people. It's doing exactly the opposite.
I agree with you.
Anyways, thank you for your time. I appreciate it. And we appreciate you.
All right. Good talking to you.
All right. God bless.
Thanks for your call. God bless you.
Sure.
Yeah, I totally agree about the use of symbolic use of the trees and so forth. I've got a series of lectures called Topical Isaiah, where I go into the various imagery that Isaiah uses frequently. So that a lot of Christians don't, you know, they have trouble with the prophets. They have trouble understanding the prophets because the prophets write in poetry. And because they write in poetry, you know, sometimes they use language that's figurative. That's what poets do. And in the case of the Hebrew prophets, and especially Isaiah, who I think set the trend for most of them in many respects, there are certain motifs and images that he uses repeatedly throughout the book of Isaiah, and which are picked up by later prophets too. Used. So I actually have a series of lectures on that at the website. It's called Topical Isaiah, or it's a topical treatment of Isaiah, going through looking at all the different motifs he used and showing how the New Testament writers understood those motifs. Well, we got that call through successfully. Let's see if we can get any others. If you'd like to give me a call, the number is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. I see the phone's lighting up. We'll see if we can get them successfully loaded up, ready for me to put on the air. Sue wrote and asked this question. Well, I'm going to hold off on Sue's question because Gary from Seattle has gotten through here. Let's talk to him. We're going to take these written questions when there are no callers. Gary from Seattle, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hello?
Hi.
Hi, Steve. This is Gary.
Yeah.
And I appreciate your program and your ministry.
Thank you.
I was just wondering, some time ago you said something that as to the fact that the Ten Commandments do not longer apply to us since we have the New Covenant.
The Old Covenant, the Ten Commandments were the stipulations of the Old Covenant. That's right.
Right. So you said they no longer apply...
The way I put it is they are not the body of legislation that applies to the New Covenant. There is a different set of, there's a different authority in the New Testament. And that is Christ.
Okay. But we still do follow the Ten Commandments to this day, don't we?
I don't. For example, the Fourth Commandment to observe the Sabbath, I don't keep it in the way the Jews did. I don't feel we're required to. I believe the spiritual fulfillment of the Sabbath is fulfilled by Christians, but not because it's in the Ten Commandments. And we don't murder or commit adultery or steal, but it has nothing to do with them being in the Ten Commandments. It has to do with Jesus.
Right.
We're followers of Jesus. Yeah.
Okay. Could I ask another quick question?
Uh-huh.
I was just wondering, during the time of Isaiah that they foretold the coming of a new king, was there a purpose that when God came down to earth as man and taught us the living waters, that he was placed during the Roman era? You know, I heard that they executed up to 500 people per day on one of the most barbaric forms of the dying on the cross.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering if there a reason why he would be placed during the Roman era.
Well, I don't really know that the Roman era would be the best of all eras if we were just looking for, you know, opportune times. God obviously had his reasons for sending Christ at the time he did. It says in Galatians 4:4 that Christ came when the fullness of time had come. And clearly there were predictions about the Roman Empire in Daniel, and that the Messiah would come and set up his kingdom during the time of that empire. So, I mean, God did pick that time, and he probably picked it for certain reasons. I don't know if I know enough about the mind of God to know all the reasons he would have used for that time.
Right, we don't know the mind of God.
Right, we might if he revealed it, but I don't know if he did reveal that particular information. Some people say, well, the time of the Roman Empire was a great time compared to previous times because the Romans had paved all these roads throughout the empire, which made it possible for Christianity to travel easily to all the nations, whereas before Roman times it was much more difficult to travel internationally. Well, that may be true, but it's hard to imagine that that's the overarching compelling reason that God sent Jesus at that time, because the roads were better. Right. There was also the Pax Romana in the time of Rome, which was not before. That is, there was no actual warfare going on in Israel or in the Mediterranean region because the Romans had subdued it before Jesus was born. And therefore, excuse me, it was a peaceable time for such travels for the apostles and so forth. But, you know, we can see those things as certain advantages that you know, facilitated the spread of the gospel. And maybe they played a role in God's thinking, but we're never told in Scripture that those were the reasons. Yeah.
Okay, thank you, Steve, and God bless you. Have a good day.
Okay, Gary, God bless you too. Bye now.
Bye.
All right, our next caller is Jay from Southern California. Jay, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling. Jay? Well, Jay hung up, it looks like. How about Julius from Las Vegas, Nevada? Julius, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Oh, thank you. I'm reading here at Isaiah 57, verse 1.
Yeah.
And I want to get a better understanding what you think about it. It said, the righteous perish, and no man lay it to heart. And the merciful man are taken away, none considering that the righteous is taken away from the evil to come. You know, I get from that verse that there are people taken away. Now, here in verse 2, it says, he shall enter into peace. They shall rest in their beds, each one walking in his righteousness. So
yes.
What I get from that, you know, men are taken away, spared from evil,
uh-huh,
and that they rest in the ground. And I I've been to a lot of funerals, and I don't see the pastors bringing this up. To me, this would be good to remind the people that they are rest in their beds in the earth. What do you think about that?
I'm with you. I mean, the death of a righteous person is in one sense a tragedy, because the earth needs more righteous people, you know, and, you know, to lose a righteous man is a significant loss to the earth. But from the standpoint of the man himself, it's not a bad thing. He goes to his rest. You know, he's taken away from the evils of this world. And so death for the believer or for the righteous person is, well, as Paul put it, to die is gain. You know, the Christian is much better off in the presence of the Lord when his time on earth here is done, because he does escape from all the future troubles, and there are troubles. Life is full of troubles. And if I had died, 40 years ago, I would have been spared a lot of troubles that I've had because I didn't die. But God wanted me to stay alive, apparently, because here I am. But if I were to die tomorrow, it could be concluded, well, I'm spared from all my other troubles that would have come on my... I mean, life is full of trouble. And so Isaiah is putting a positive spin on the fact that a lot of righteous people were dying in his day. And he says no one is considering what this means. It suggests that evil times are coming, and God is, sparing these people from that. I think Isaiah's message was one of coming judgment, of course. And I believe he was interpreting the fact that many righteous people had apparently died in over a short period of time to being one of the evidences that God has, got something bad coming down the pike for people, and he's taken good people out before they have to face it.
Well, that's true, too, but I believe what Revelation 12 and 11 say, they overcame by the blood of the Lamb and by the words of their testimony. Now, I'm not hearing a lot of teaching of that we overcome by what Jesus did. The Bible said Jesus delivered us from the curse of the law. Under the curse of the law, sickness, death, and poverty.
Okay, but it seems to me like that's a different subject than Isaiah 57:1.
That's going into, we were talking about everybody going to have problems.
Yeah.
But see, there we made a way out through Jesus Christ that we don't have to go into these problems. We can overcome problems. You know, I heard a lot of pastors talking about...
Wait. Are you saying that if we have enough faith, our life will be problem-free?
No, you overcome it. The problems won't affect
you. Okay. All right.
A lot of problems affect people, and you can tell in their attitude and what they say.
Okay.
I agree with that.
I agree that a man who trusts God in the midst of his trials...
Right.
is going to overcome. You see, the trials are there can potentially overcome you and bring you down and destroy your faith in your life, but that won't happen if you're trusting God. I think that's what you're saying, and I agree with you. Let's talk to Jay from, also apparently from Southern California. Oh, this is Jay that we got hung up on before. Hi, Jay. Welcome. Hello, Jay?
Steve?
Yes.
I was going to comment on the other caller had, the brother in the Jewish faith. I'm sort of like that myself, a messianic, born again blue believer. And I was going to say that the morning star and all that kind of stuff has to do with, like Isaiah 28. So, and it's, and I'm thinking it's the same thing as Isaiah was. Isaiah was before the captivity, of course, before Jeremiah even, and Ezekiel was a contemporary of Daniel. So,
right. As
Daniel was talking about the different realms of spirituality, I believe that Isaiah was, foreshadowing a prophecy about that king, which happened before. He actually did his, before he came down, the king of Tyre, And the same thing in, Ezekiel. And I think it's the same thing. It's all spiritual things, sir. And I believe that the Babylon has never changed. I believe there is Babylon right now, a Babylon realm of spirituality, evil spoken realm. I mean, the same people that, I'm saying, influence the same spiritual evil people, being influenced people in Babylon.
Okay. Hey, Jay, I'm not quite sure. I'm not quite sure where you're going. Is this a question or is this a disagreement?
It's sort of like both. So I was trying to say, Steve, that I believe that this whole thing is a spiritual realm.
Okay.
I believe you're saying emphasizing the spiritual realm of this whole, because there's spiritual people here today. The people that are doing the evil stuff today, we're in Babylon today, sir, and Rome. And they're battling against each other because it's always been in contention. You know what I'm saying?
Well, I'll tell you what. I have to say, I don't see anything in the passage in Isaiah 14, which I think is what you're talking about, though you said Isaiah 28. I think you're talking about Isaiah 14, and you might be thinking of Ezekiel 28. You also mentioned the king of Tyre. That's from Ezekiel 28. The king of Babylon is in view in Isaiah 14. So I think you're maybe even misspeaking what you intend to speak, and it's making it very hard to follow your thoughts. But you're saying that these are spiritual. My thought is, well, I know there are spiritual things. I know there are spiritual things in reality, and there's spiritual things mentioned in the Bible. But I don't believe I have the right to spiritualize things in the Bible without any reason. And when I read Isaiah 14, a prophecy about what is said to be about the fall of the king of Babylon, and it makes perfectly good sense to me, in taking it quite as it is, for what it says it is. Likewise with Ezekiel 28, the fall of Tyre, the king of Tyre. I have no problem taking it exactly as Ezekiel says it, although recognizing the symbolism, that's not the same thing as saying it's spiritual. To say something is symbolic isn't the same thing as saying it's spiritual. Those are different concepts. But, so your position is that these passages talk about spiritual things, apparently maybe the spiritual power behind the throne and so forth. And in saying that, you're not in bad company. Lots of Christians think that. My position is that the passages themselves don't actually give us any clues that they're to be taken that way. But I appreciate your call, Jay. Thank you for calling. Esty from Freeland. Now, Freeland, is that in Washington or California? Where is that? Washington.
Yes,
okay,
Washington.
Welcome.
Well, thank you. I kind of didn't hear all of what you were telling the other person about Isaiah, but you said something about trees, and that I kind of called spontaneously without the scripture in front of me, but there was a time when Jesus was healing a blind man, and the man said, "I see men walking as trees."
Yeah.
And that has always been like a little thing saying, there's something more to that than what I'm seeing. And then he spit or did the sob or clay or whatever and healed him completely. But I always wondered what that was about. And then just earlier, you mentioned something about Isaiah and men as trees. So I'm curious to know what you're talking about because I'm not familiar with it. And I want to know if it's
okay.
What it's about.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Esty. Well, first of all, let me talk about the healing of the blind man. Then I'll talk about Isaiah and the trees. When Jesus healed the blind man, this is the only case we read of in the Bible where Jesus healed somebody progressively or in two steps rather than in one. Jesus healed lots of blind people in his ministry, and many of them are recorded, and there's probably many more that are not recorded. But this is the only case we read of where Jesus healed a man, or I should say partially healed him. And the man was healed somewhat, but not all the way, and then Jesus touched him again, and then he was completely healed. And with the first touch of Jesus, the blind man was able to see somewhat, but not clearly. And Jesus said, "What do you see?" And the man said, "I see men like trees walking." Now, I think what he means by that is I can see people and I can see them moving, but they're not clear. I mean, I can't make out their faces and things like that clearly. It's they might as well be just trees moving about, as far as the clarity of my vision is concerned. I don't know that he's saying something that has deep spiritual significance there. I think he's simply saying, my vision isn't clear yet. You know, I can see men moving around, but it's more like, I mean, they don't look much different than trees would look moving around. So, I'm not seeing very clearly yet. Now, I consider it to be maybe possibly an unrelated point that in the Old Testament and the New, men are sometimes compared with trees. I mean, Jesus does that when he talks about false prophets. He says, you'll know them by their fruits. You don't gather good fruit from a bad tree. And you don't gather, bad fruit from a good tree. He's talking about prophets and their fruit. He's comparing them with trees. John the Baptist compared the apostate Jews with trees. He said that Jesus is coming with his axe laid to the root, and he's going to cut down every fruitless tree and cast it into the fire. He's talking about the evil among the Jews, the apostate among the Jews. So we have this New Testament usage of trees, but we do in the Old Testament too, and we have it in Isaiah. Not infrequently, the reference to trees clapping their hands was mentioned. I think that's in Isaiah 55:12, if I'm not mistaken. Yes, it is, Isaiah 55:12, Also, Isaiah 61 talks about when the Messiah comes, that that the righteous will be called, the righteous people will be called trees of righteousness, the planting of the Lord, that he may be glorified. And there's many, many other places where people are compared with trees in a figurative sense in the prophets. Sometimes a whole forest being leveled is an image that the prophets will use for the wiping out of a whole society or a whole army or something like that. So it's just that's just symbolic imagery there. But as far as its relevance to the man who said he saw men like trees walking, I don't know that he's trying to say anything cryptic or anything deep or spiritual or hidden. I think what he's just saying is, I'm not seeing men looking like men. They're looking like something else, not like men. So in other words, I'm not completely healed yet. I need better vision than this. I think that was the point he was making, rather than maybe something deeper than that. But in reading the prophets, you do often find trees being used as images for people in the poetic language. And so also in Jesus and John the Baptist usage and such. You're listening to The Narrow Path. I think we've gotten over our phone line issues. I think we can process the calls. We have no calls waiting, but we have about 6.5 minutes left. So if you'd like to get through, we've got time for another call or maybe two. If you want to give me a call, the number is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. And now we can come to Richard's question that he wrote in. Is it a sin to use profanity if you do not take the name of the Lord in vain? All right, so he's taking it for granted that the third commandment, you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, refers to profane usage of God's name. But he wonders, is it wrong to use profanity otherwise, if you're not taking the name of the Lord in vain? I guess using words that we might call cuss words. And the truth of the matter is that there is no set of words, you know, some universal set of words that for all time in all languages are cuss words or profanity. Profanity is defined differently in different cultures. There are words in England that would be called cuss words in English that we use over here and we don't call them cuss words. I discovered this many years ago. I mean, the word bum is a very innocent word in America, but it's kind of a coarse word in England, in Britain. It's just different. It's used differently. The word bloody has very different connotations in Britain than in America. And in every language, every society has its words that are considered to be rude or coarse. And the real question is not, is there a sin in speaking such words? But the question is, how are we supposed to speak in general, and what's the usage we're making of such words? The main principle for Christian speech is given in Ephesians chapter 4, where Paul said in verse 29, let no corrupt communication proceed out of your mouth. Well, that's hard to define. What's a corrupt communication? Well, he explains it by giving the contrast. What is not a corrupt communication? He says, let no corrupt communication proceed out of your mouth, but what is good for necessary edification, that it may impart grace to the hearers. So he says, don't speak this kind of way, but speak this kind of way. The way he says not to speak, he calls corrupt communication. What's that? Well, it's when you're not speaking words that could be edifying to your hearers, and you're not ministering grace to them. In other words, you're coming from a spiritual place that is unedifying, because there's no words which spoken by themselves will necessarily edify another person. It has much more to do with the spirit in which they're spoken. It says in Ephesians 5, 3 and 4, but fornication and all uncleanness or covetousness, let it not even be named among you as is fitting for saints, neither filthiness nor foolish talking nor coarse jesting, which are not fitting, but rather giving of thanks. So coarse jesting, unfitting speech. The main thing to realize is the Bible says that out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. And there's no set of words that the Bible would list somewhere there. These are bad words. You can't use these words. The word hell, when I was growing up, was a shocking word for Christians anyway. I mean, if someone said, oh, hell, or go to hell, or something like that, that was considered very, very coarse language. Of course, as a Christian, I use the word hell in a theological sense. It's not a bad word. It depends, though, on the usage. It's not the word itself that's the problem. It's the intent and the spirit behind the person who's using the word and what they're intending to convey. And I believe the Christian's goal is to always, as much as possible, edify others with our speech and minister grace to them. And therefore, if we do not do that, then we seem to be in violation of the standard that the Bible teaches. Death from Salinas. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hi. I was just, I guess, more have a comment than a question, maybe.
Uh-huh.
It's in regard to the men. I see men walking the streets.
Mm-hmm.
And it reminds me of, many decades back when my husband and I had kind of gotten involved in this thing in the Midwest, Faith Assembly, and it was Hobart Freeman with...
Mm-hmm. Oh, boy.
Yeah, that was in our rural county that we are
major
from.
Major word of faith.
Yeah, and having been intricately involved in that for the better part of a year, I just happened to turn your show on, and I'm hearing this discussion about this, and I've never thought of it before, but it kind of comes to mind how many people in that movement and probably others similar feel like you can't be honest about where you are physically,
right?
You know, in a healing. There were so many times where, you know, people weren't healed, but it became this measure of faith to be able to say, well, I'm healed. I've already received my healing.
Right.
And any verbalization of otherwise indicates a lack of belief and a lack of faith that our healing was already.
That is one of my great complaints about the Word of Faith teaching, and that is that it requires people to lie, really. I mean, I think the point you're making is this man who was partially healed admitted that he was only partially healed. He didn't say, oh, I'm healed. And yet Jesus further healed him. And as the Word of Faith says, you will have what you say. And therefore, even if you're sick, you should say you're well because you're going to get what you say. In other words, you're going to control reality by what you confess to be true. Well, that's not true. That's esoteric religion. That's not Christianity. That's like Christian Science more than anything else. But the truth is that in the Bible, when people were sick, they said so. And in many cases, they got healed anyway. Paul himself indicated that his friend Trophimus was sick. He said, I left Trophimus sick in Miletus. He admitted that Timothy had, a stomach infirmity that was chronic and that he should take a little wine for that, he said. There's his friend Epaphras had been sick, he said, almost died. He got better, but he almost died because he was so sick. Paul didn't talk as if you're supposed to hide the fact that you're sick and be so embarrassed of it. It's a reality. But the Word of Faith teaching basically teaches people, don't admit it if you're sick. Say you're well. And we don't see that modeled in this man who said, I see men like trees walking. If he was a Word of Faith guy, he should have said, oh, no, I see everything just fine. Thanks, Jesus. And even though he didn't. Now, being honest is far more important than making positive confessions, especially the ones that are not true. The problem with Hobart Freeman is, as you know, his teaching goes so far as to say it's a sin to go to see a doctor. And there have been, last I read, and this was years ago, the number's probably risen, there over 90 people died in his church who could have been helped with simple medical intervention. But they didn't go because his teaching told them not to go. So this is another bad effect of the Word of Faith teaching when it's taken as far as some people do, like Hobart Freeman. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg. We do this Monday through Friday. We are a listener-supported ministry. If you'd like to help us pay the radio bills, that's what your money will go toward if you send any. You can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. That address can be found at our website, or you can donate from the website if you want to. It's thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Let's talk again tomorrow. God bless.